My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my instructor will be Ira J. Black, who, according to his LinkedIn profile, is an iconoclast emeritus. He was a professor at Houston Community College for 25 years, where he taught whatever the hell he felt like. He was a classical music announcer on KLEF, which was Houston's classical station, up until it changed to a light rock station in 1986. He did his doctoral work at the City University of New York in comic philosophy. But my favorite thing about Ira is that he apparently enjoys painting samurai figurines. Ira, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you for the offer.
What are we going to be talking about today?
We're going to talk about comedy.
All right.
Because every time I say that I did my degree work in comic philosophy, people laugh. So I figured if you can get a laugh out of that, you can get a laugh out of anything. But I've always been interested in comedy and the broad ranges, the spectrum of comedy. Both philosophically, but also because I enjoyed a good joke. And I have, I guess, since I was a kid, I was thinking about it. You know, I kind of gravitated toward humor.
Yeah.
And in music especially, and I grew up at a time when music was terribly serious. I mean, you know, sit up straight. You know, if you're listening at home, you have to sit up straight. You have to wear a tie and a jacket.
Or else, like, what would happen if you didn't?
Oh, it would just ruin the entire experience for all the people who can't see you, you know? And at that time, I didn't really, you know, appreciate the other side of it. And basically what we're going to start with is one of the best jokes in music is by Papa Haydn, the second movement of the Surprise Symphony. And you have to realize that, you know, humor, comedy happens in context. Mm-hmm. Humor is like a really fine white wine. It doesn't travel very well.
Mm-hmm.
Tragedy is a piece of cake. You can always make somebody cry.
Sure.
Getting them to laugh takes skill on your part, and it takes the wherewithal for them to understand it, to understand the context. So who is Haydn writing for? He's writing for a cultured audience. He's writing for people who have a little bit more wit than your average guy. Granted, some of them were not terribly bright. I'm thinking of Mozart's Emperor Joseph, not the brightest guy in the world, you know, there's too many notes.
Yeah.
But they appreciated the context. The social context of it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So he's writing for his audience. He's not saying, I just wrote this here, you know, do with it what you will. But he's writing for them. He knows what they're expecting. So when he comes to using humor in his music, Haydn is the king of comedy. He really is. Because he knows how to build it. You know, he just doesn't do it gratuitously. And this example, the Surprise Symphony, is a perfect example. Noel Coward once said, any idiot can tell one joke. He said, it takes someone with skill and comic skill to build on that joke and to create a structure. And that's exactly what Haydn is going to do, as we're about to hear. He takes the really dumbest little tune. Mm-hmm. The tune for this movement is really, it's the kind of thing you'd play on a piano if you didn't have the dexterity to play chopsticks. All right? That's
okay.
Basically it. And then he runs it through the mill of variations that juxtapose this dumb little tune with pretentiousness, with bombast, with some very charming little pieces, too, some charming variations, even one that's maladroit. You have a sense that this is a dance for people wearing unlaced combat boots. And then he brings it back to the original tune that sounds like it's been dragged through the mill. And again, you know, you're laughing is the way I'm describing it. That's, I laugh when I hear
okay,
it.
Okay, I gotta hear this.
So let's put, yeah, yeah, why don't we play that right now? So there's your tune. Dasha's nodding off.
Yeah, I'm falling asleep. Here I go. Good Lord.
He makes you complacent with the tune, and then he rings in that surprise. I mean, perfectly lovely music otherwise, but if you juxtapose it with that, you get comedy.
Yeah.
And then we get this little group coming out in tutus all of a sudden.
It's so putting those two very...
Yeah. See, now, you really don't need the rest of it there to get that's, you know, that works.
Yeah.
It's that juxtaposition there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. How he keeps changing it up, it's so sort of unnerving.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't just sort of settle in and listen to the music.
Which is what he's going for.
Really? Okay.
He says it's like a Jack in the Box.
Yeah,
you never know where it's going to go, and boom, there it is, you know. See, but always coming back to this little innocuous tune, which sets up the joke for the next step up. The reason, one of the major problems, is that we tend to be complacent with what we're listening to, that we end up listening either at the music or we listen past the music.
Right, yeah.
Instead of becoming engaged in it. And Haydn is saying, no, you have to be engaged.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you the incentive.
By making schizophrenic music that you have to.
Well, comedy is based on juxtaposition and surprise.
Yeah.
Both of those have to be there to make comedy work.
Yeah.
Because you take the expected and then you flip it on its head.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. He's definitely done that. God.
This is to keep the orchestra from falling asleep.
I feel like this is the music that captors might play when they're trying to keep a captive awake, you know, and deprive them of sleep. They would just blare this on speakers.
So it's more surprising than you actually think, and because it's built on a structure of surprises.
Yeah.
And juxtaposition and surprise are the two major ingredients in comedy, is taking something you expect and then flipping it on its head.
Yeah.
And we would imagine Haydn's audience got that. Now, it's also worth noting, it is unlikely that the audience hearing this would ever hear it again. But for them, it was a real-life first moment experience, which makes the joke even better.
Yeah.
It makes the comedy even better because he knows that they don't know what's coming.
Yeah.
And they want to pay attention because they'll never hear it again.
I see. Well, where are we going next in our comedic journey?
Where we're going next is we're going to jump to the 20th century.
Okay.
Okay. And we're going to jump to a comic review that was wildly successful in London and Broadway at the beginning of the 60s.
Okay.
This is, you know, there was life in the 60s, Dasha. Okay. It was all black and white. Of course, God hadn't given us color yet. But and it was called Beyond the Fringe. Four brilliant ex-Oxford, Cambridge students.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of like pre-Monty Python.
Yeah.
It was Jonathan Miller, who went on to a distinguished career as a neurosurgeon.
What?
And a producer and director of operas and Shakespeare.
Oh my goodness.
Alan Bennett, who is one of England's foremost playwrights today.
Mm-hmm.
And two guys I'm sure nobody's ever heard of. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Wow.
This is where they all began.
Okay.
And they did wild comedy, but they were doing it again for audiences that were clued in.
Mm-hmm.
It was for the audience of London,
mm-hmm.
which is still a high-class theater audience, and New York.
Mm-hmm.
So they could make jokes for an audience that got it. Now, on it, in addition to the spoken comedy, we have some musical parodies, and we're going to listen to two of them.
Okay.
The first one is called "And the Same to You," and I think anyone would recognize the composer. Quote, composer is Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
They should recognize the tune that he uses for this set of variations, and I'll give you a hint. 1957, there was a wildly popular movie, which has become a movie classic, and this was the principal theme from that. Got the tune? Imagine his face
mm-hmm.
is reacting to
yeah.
what he's playing here.
I can totally see him.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to have a fugue. Here's the finale. See how long it takes. Not yet. Wait for it. I remember Dudley Moore, who was the pianist. I actually saw it in New York when I was a kid. And the look on his face was of exasperation. It's like, where does this end? Where does this end until finally it does?
Imagining Dudley Moore's face.
Yes.
starting at this point.
Yeah. There we go.
Oh my God. That was ridiculous.
You know, Sotler wrote a play, No Exit, and I have a feeling that's how Dudley Moore felt when he was playing that. You know, how do I get out of here? You know, and he probably had a hose down his hands.
Yeah.
But you know, you can hear from the audience that one, they get the joke.
Yeah.
You know, they get the Colonel Bogey March. Okay, now that was the easy one because Bridge on the River Kwai, which came out in 1957. Spawned a whole raft of spoofs.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I mean, everybody found ways to do parodies of Colonel Bogey. And here along come Beyond the Fringe in 61, and this is their send-up of it. But also the send-up of the piano recital, which, yeah. Again, this is an audience that probably knows this because there were a lot of them. You know, you could go to Carnegie Hall. You could go to Town Hall. You could go to various other venues around the city. So they're familiar with the vocabulary, the social vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
that they get
mm-hmm.
it. Now, the second song is even more, it's even more complex. One of the features that they use throughout Beyond the Fringe are parodies of song recitals, which, again, were very, very popular, where you'd have, you know, Madame So-and-so with a hyphenated German last name doing an evening of Schumann or Schubert mm-hmm. or Hugo Wolf. And always, you know, with her little notebook, little black book with the lyrics so that she could just check them, and her pianist. And they were very, very popular, and they were really wonderfully done. I mean, this is not to make fun of the people doing them, but imagine the incomprehensibility for an audience that doesn't speak German
mm-hmm.
hearing an entire recital of these songs.
Yeah.
Now, typically, there would always be an MC who would introduce each song in plummy tones, describing the scenario of the song. Because
yeah.
each of those songs, and Schubert started it, he's creating little dramas in his songs. Each song has a scenario. It's not just some flighty little lyric, but there's a scenario here. So we always have this plummy voice explaining that Madame So-and-so will now sing this song. All right? So we have that parody. Then it's a parody on the music of Benjamin Britten. Now, Benjamin Britten was still writing at the time, and he made popular a set of English folk songs and nursery songs that he arranged, that he set for voice and piano.
Mm-hmm.
And he created art songs out of these artless songs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we have that. We're going to have fun with that. And he always wrote them for his companion, his partner, Peter Peers, who is a noted English tenor. All his major operatic roles that Britten wrote were written for Peter Peers, Peter Grimes. And he had, I'm going to describe it neutrally, as an idiosyncratic voice.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Once you heard it, you knew you never would hear another voice like this. All right?
Okay.
It was a very, very special Peter Peers voice. So we're going to have fun with that, too. This is called Little Miss Britten.
Okay.
And now, Dudley Moore continues to accompany himself at the pianoforte, this time in settings of British songs. A setting by Benjamin Britten of the old English heir, Little Miss Muffet. The Miss Muffet referred to in this song is believed to have been the daughter of Thomas Muffet, a 17th century entomologist.
That's good.
And that's typical Britain. Piers had a way with wavering pitch.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Oh my.
It's so Britain.
Yeah.
It is so Benjamin Britten.
Well, I say that like I know it. I don't know that.
I mean, it's silliness in the service of, in a way, honoring Benjamin Britten.
Yeah.
You know, but it encapsulates the recital program. Got to make fun of that. Mm-hmm. Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears singing Benjamin Britten.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, the audience, they know about this.
They're familiar with all of these things. And so for them, this is like
Which is why we have to explain it now.
Yeah. You know? I think you hit upon something really interesting there, because I've been thinking the whole time, like, what job is it that comedy does? What value is it that comedy brings to our understanding of this music? And I think that's it, that it is poking fun at things, and that in doing so, it's highlighting them and making you look at them in a way that sort of takes them out of context and makes you sort of inspect them. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. It does. It makes you an active participant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said before, tragedy, tragedy, serious stuff. Well, I mean, anybody can cry and not even know why they're crying. Uh-huh. And believe me, I still cry in Hamlet.
Babies cry. Anybody can do it.
I'd go further than that. Grown-ups cry. But, you know, but what we tend to label are really rather more sentimental. Comedy is not sentimental. Comedy is really testing the mettle of things. I love seriousness,
mm-hmm.
you know. I respect seriousness. Mm-hmm. I admire seriousness, but I don't revere it. And what happens is we tend to revere things. Where it's serious, we must take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't take everything that way. We have to realize that there's a broader spectrum. Now, going beyond that to say that the comedian is no less serious than anybody else's. In fact, I would say he's more serious. One of the most serious people I know is Steve Martin.
Right? Yes.
Right?
And he is just freaking hilarious.
His comedy is brilliant. It's insightful.
Well, he writes very serious. His novels are really serious.
Yeah.
And he plays the banjo, which seems silly, but he's so good at it.
And if you're listening to him in interviews,
mm-hmm.
he's not a bundle of yaks.
He's a really intelligent
guy. He's a very serious guy.
Yeah.
Very serious guy. I mean, I love the L.A. Story. And I love mm-hmm. Roxanne. I can watch them over and over again because of the incisiveness of his humor. But there is also a serious intent beneath it. And I think, again, comedy leavens
mm-hmm.
things. Comedy gives us perspective. It's a survival instinct of the species. Why do we need comedy? Yes. Otherwise, we'd all commit suicide.
Exactly.
We can't live in a state of tragedy
time. So, okay, given that statement right there, you know, there is good and bad music in all genres.
Mm-hmm.
Why classical music? Why so serious?
Oh, I don't think we have time to get into that one, Dacia.
Well,
look at it this way. Musicians don't work music. They play music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, a lot of work goes into that.
I don't want to
deprecate my friends, the musicians, to say, well, they're just knocking it off. No, they work real hard at it. But in reality, in performance,
mm-hmm.
they are playing music. There is something to that word. And that's not just an English word, because the Germans use a similar word to refer. Yeah, a Tonkünstler is a player of tones, is a musician.
Okay.
A Kunst is a game or a joke. So we've understood that.
So, like, it's universal.
But maybe we've gotten away for it. You know, gotten away from it because, well, for us, we're an adopted country.
Mm-hmm.
As we said before, we're the adopted country. We adopted European arts to this country. And it's a kind of, self-consciousness about it. So maybe if it's European, it's good. And it's good for you. You know, and we've labored under that. We have labored under that. I mean, I labored under that when I was growing up and only came to really appreciate all this until, I was already out of college when I came to appreciate, if I take it on its own terms and I take it on my terms, mm-hmm. this is something I can live with. I want to live with it,
mm-hmm.
not say, oh, no, I've got to go into the room and be very, very quiet now.
Right.
You know, and I think that really is what it's coming down to. And I think I'm beginning to see that. I mean, I have a basic comic disposition. So I'm seeing improvement. I'm beginning to see
that's good. That kind of I'm definitely seeing it too. I mean, and I'm very new to this world, but I definitely found that there's an openness, you know, amongst people in the classical music world to having fun and to, you know, being a little adventurous.
Yeah.
We should, if you want to get to the last piece.
We have to have a finale. And there's an ironclad rule, a law engraved in stone, that at the end of a classical symphony, you have to send the audience out happy.
Yeah.
Right? You got to end it on an upbeat, right, babe?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to play my favorite. I love this finale. I mean, and Haydn is just chock full of them. It's the conclusion of the Symphony No. 92, the Oxford Symphony.
Okay.
And since comedy is subjective, you know, it's what you find funny and how you visualize it. What I visualize when I hear this, now, nobody else may see it this way. People may think I'm crazy, but I'm used to that. It's okay. I imagine a Prius tootling down the highway and this big 18-wheeler trying to intimidate it.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Just tootle along, right? There we go.
Okay.
Got the truck?
Yeah.
But what's great about it is that the Prius wins. All right, that's comedy.
Of course it does. It gets better gas mileage.
It's fun.
This is Haydn.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I was about to say, this composer is using the same tactic that Haydn used in the Surprise Symphony.
Isn't that remarkable?
Way to pay attention, Dacia.
We always come back to the tootler.
It almost kind of sounds like somebody who is running and gets knocked down.
Okay, yeah.
And just
that's
starts up again. Yeah.
That's a good image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see the movie WALL-E?
Mm-mm. No,
well, there's this little robot.
Yeah.
In the movie, his name is Mo, and he his job is the most thankless thing, which is just to clean up dirt all the time. And I'm just seeing this little robot as I'm listening to this music, like, just buzzing around.
Yeah, that works too.
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine coming out into the lobby after hearing that? You want to go right over and buy the CD.
I don't know. I feel worn out. I mean, that's just like aurally.
That is just
challenging.
It is so much fun. Haydn must have had a really wonderful life.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole outlook was a comic outlook. When people asked him, you know, like, you spent 30 years living out in the Tulies, because Esterházy is like on the Hungarian border.
That's his nowhere land. Okay.
It's nowhere land. You know, but of course, he is the head of a musical establishment that's incredible because his prince knew good music and was a man of taste. Mm-hmm. And they asked Haydn, well, you know, what was it like, you know, being away from the centers of art? He said, no, he says, but being here, cut off from all of those, I was able to refine my own art and experiment with my own art and develop my own art. That's a comic answer. Instead of saying, yeah, like, geez, if I'd been in Vienna or if I'd been in London. But no. He said, no. There's much to be said for the life I had.
Yeah.
He's a guy I'd like to meet. I'd like to meet Haydn.
Well, when I finally invent my time machine, which, you know, I work
mark
on all the time.
Mark me down for the trip.
Okay, you're on the list.
Mark me down for the trip, yeah.
Ira, thank you so much for coming on to the show. I really appreciate it. I've learned a lot.
I have so much enjoyed doing this, Desha. I can't tell you how much.
Super
thank
fun.
You so much.
Everybody, thanks for listening to The Classical Classroom. If you have any questions or if you would like for us to address a topic on this show, send me an email at dclay@classical917.org. If you want to hear past episodes or see all of the brilliant content that we have on our webpage, go to classical917.org/classroom. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.